to CryptoCurrent, the only podcast to bring you beginner and advanced knowledge of cryptocurrency and blockchain, analyses of cryptocurrency markets, and discussions on growing a business within the crypto space. Stay tuned and stay CryptoCurrent. I'm your host, Michelle, who will be guiding all of you who are new to the crypto world through my journey to becoming a crypto and blockchain expert. Today's episode will focus on the very important question of why should we even care about cryptocurrency? While it makes sense for investors, technologists, and businessmen to learn about and care for it, why should, let's say, the average American be concerned with this emerging market?
Quick question. By the way, my name is Richard, and I'm going to be joining Michelle today. I'm just trying to get a better understanding for this myself, too. So why should I care?
Well, just a few months ago, I was asking myself that very question. I knew the basics of what a cryptocurrency was, but I only thought that it was important for people in the data science and supply chain business world. I knew that the underlying technology, which is the blockchain, significantly sped up business processes, and I knew that some unnamed friends had used Bitcoin about 4 to 5 years ago to buy fake IDs.
Wow.
But I was still under the impression that neither one of these technologies would have any real relevance to my life. And we're kind of destined to live on the fringes, like a passing fad that, while it was interesting, didn't really have any basis in my life or the lives of those I knew and loved. But at that time, there was an emerging trend, actually, that I was particularly interested in, which is the sharing economy.
Hold up. I've actually never heard of the sharing economy. Like, what do you mean by that?
So this idea actually came about with the rise of the internet and big data, which allowed asset owners and those who are looking to use said assets to interact with one another. This is otherwise known as a peer-to-peer network. Why this interested me so much was because it has the potential, and actually already has in many ways, increased consumption and market efficiency. So, for example, Richard, car sharing services like Uber and Lyft help mitigate the fact that privately owned cars go unused for 95% of their lifetime. Also, Airbnb is between 30 and 60% cheaper than hotel rates and help homeowners make money off of extra rooms otherwise being unused. And besides those two famous examples, the rise of freelancing platforms helps skilled workers to be matched with appropriate jobs, and peer-to-peer lending platforms allow people to obtain loans from other individuals at cheaper interest rates than a traditional credit lending institution.
Wow.
So if you already understand the relevancy of blockchain technology like you know, you probably noticed how it could aid in every one of these processes mentioned above.
Absolutely.
Ensuring privacy to decrease gender or racial bias on Airbnb, or increasing trust on peer-to-peer lending platforms. And that was exactly how I began learning about blockchain. And through my research, I realized that blockchain technology and its cryptocurrency counterpart have the potential to do three things I deeply care about in regard to the economy. They increase trust and cooperation between businesses and individuals. They distribute purchasing and monetary power more fairly. And they increase efficiency and security of existing business and technological processes. So, in order to understand how cryptocurrency and blockchain tech can actually influence the economy, it's important to know how the economy has been shaped by money and institutional power over time.
Let's take a moment to just sit on that for a minute. So, you're about to break down to me how deep and how far back money has evolved over time and how basically cryptocurrency is now taking over that order.
Well, I don't think we're going to go into the full history of money. That would probably take a few hours. I think we got about 6 minutes left. But but what I'll do is I'll kind of go through the way that money has influenced our society in the past, 100 years, kind of going into a couple different societies, a couple different countries and their histories, and then how that money is tied, inherently to power. And power of institutions and governments, organizations. And then I'll go into, how cryptocurrency has been able to alleviate the misuse of that power. So
beautiful.
So first I'll start with kind of what these all boil down to, which inherently is value.
Okay.
Right? And so when we spend our money, we're attempting to make an equivalent value exchange, trading our hard-earned cash for a good or service, right? And also, when you get promoted to a new position, it's because you're adding more value to the company. Or when you trust the dollar bill to keep track of your earnings and savings, you're valuing the financial and monetary system that upholds it. And trust that others will also value your dollar at the agreed upon amount. Now, all of this sounds pretty simple. That is until you think about how we value the money in and of itself. Like, what is the inherent value of that money? So let's pretend for a moment that tomorrow, Richard, you wake up and you go to buy a computer, and all of a sudden the price is 20 grand.
Okay. Not going to happen. Not buying it.
We'll see. But that's because the money supply increased and we experienced a very, very severe form of hyperinflation. So let's say you only have 30 grand saved in the bank and you're prepared to spend maybe 2 grand on a laptop. Now you have to sacrifice 66% of your savings rather than 6%. So even though you should have had the same amount of value stored in your savings, now your hard work is worth around 1.5 computers rather than that new beautiful Ford Mustang you always wanted. So now, again, you might think that's impossible. The money supply would never increase that drastically. And perhaps you're right. But if we take a journey back in time to the aftermath of World War I, the German government, in an effort to maintain its economic power in the world, did something very similar. In fact, actually, school children were seen playing with stacks of 50 million gold marks, the currency at the time, because of how worthless the currency became to its citizens. This monetary insecurity eventually set up the stage for Hitler's regime and caused widespread panic and mistrust. And even today, countries like Venezuela and Zimbabwe are facing constant monetary insecurity, all because of the ability for their governments to increase the money supply and redistribute money as they see fit. So, in order to store your value in a way that gives you assured purchasing power and sets you up to have a solid life savings, you have to trust that your government is either so powerful that we'll never enter into a situation like those mentioned above, or you trust that even in such a situation, the government will not essentially screw you over.
Very important, because as much as I love taxes and not getting screwed over by the government, they kind of got a history.
Yeah, they do. So, and because of that, we enter into this circle of mistrust where if citizens don't trust the government, then they don't trust its currency. And then if they don't trust its currency, then they convert their money into something more secure, like gold. This then causes a loss of value in the currency itself because it's not being used to make exchanges or hold value anymore. And then in turn, that takes away from the government's financial resources and causes them to print more money to pay their debts. And then that creates even more mistrust and hyperinflation. So we can see this kind of negative feedback loop that's going on here.
Definitely.
And so the dollar bills in your wallet right now are worth a particular amount at this time. And this is due to the U.S.'s economic power and the worldwide trust in the dollar. And if for any myriad of reasons, war, financial crises, you name it, the government faces a dilemma where they do need to print large amounts of money, your store of value will decrease and decrease, and like the paper marks in Germany, could eventually become almost obsolete. You are left with a bunch of pieces of paper that really have no intrinsic value. You can't sell them or even use them for anything besides maybe a bookmark. While we used to be on a gold standard, where at least you could turn in your money for good old-fashioned gold, right? Now our source of value for the dollar comes from tax credit. And this is essentially the payment for tax liabilities that is owed to the government. And if citizens have to pay taxes in the form of that government's currency, then that currency is then given value. So as long as the government isn't overspending so that they'll have to increase the money supply to pay off their debts, and no drastic events happen to the economy, people can feel relatively safe holding on to a particular currency. But there's actually more to the story in terms of currency, because not only do we have to trust the governments to have our best interests in mind and be so powerful that no unforeseen economic event will plummet the value of the dollar, but we also now have to trust banks. So because storing your currency as pure paper bills is insecure and inefficient, we rely on financial institutions to allow us to use large and specific amounts of money with ease and provide a trusted way to offer the credit and debit services that we rely on.
Yeah, just like you said, that's putting in a whole lot of trust in a system.
Right, and we trust these banks to not misuse the money that we're storing with them, right? And we in turn are compensated with interest for giving them our money so they can in turn make money off of providing loans. But now we're not just trusting a government that we elect and help regulate, but we're also trusting the financial institutions that are privately owned and profit maximizing, and they have the ability to debase the currency at any time. So unfortunately, we don't have to travel back very far to when the system didn't work out in our favor, right? The 2008 financial crisis, which everybody is familiar with. So because at this time, banks gave out risky loans to attract new customers, who then in turn didn't pay their debts, many of these banks faced collapse and filed for bankruptcy. Neither the government nor the public knew that these loans were risky, as they were inputted as safe loans rather than risky ones by the bankers themselves, And so when the banks failed after the loans failed, not only did it come as a surprise to everyone, but all of a sudden, the money that people kept in the banks that did go bankrupt became worthless. So at this point, in came the government to bail out the banks and give people back their life savings. But, you know, this money that the government was giving out, you know, came from the very taxes that people paid. So the bankers themselves faced little financial trouble compared to the losses of money in the public and businesses that had trusted these banks to keep their money safe. So this created a huge amount of economic instability and loss of jobs all over the country.
And okay, mind me asking real quick. Mm-hmm. Once this happened, how did we get out of this, right? So once this financial crisis happened, are we still putting that same trust back into banks? Like what are the next steps that have come since then?
Right, exactly. So you would think, right, that after the 2008 financial crisis that we would say, okay, whoa. Clearly, we can't put our trust in banks, right? Because they can kind of just do whatever they want with the loans. They can, hide the fact that they're giving out risky loans. So you'd think that we would have a lot of policies in place, right? But, you know, we only arrested one person, right? One investment banker out of all the people that, that misused this trust.
Wow.
And while the economy took a major hit, and people did begin to mistrust both the government and banks, the government decided to bail them out, right? Because they realized that the short-term effects of the financial crisis would have been so drastic. Like if people's whole life savings, and the whole country went away, then we would kind of, I don't know if we'd, go into anarchy, but it probably would be a lot worse than if the government just bailed out these institutions and gave people back at least part of their life savings, right?
Right.
But the problem is that the government never put in any real legislation to ensure that the banks don't have the power to misuse this trust again. People kind of just forgot about it. They said, oh, well, that was really scary. I guess we're not going to do, these mortgages on homes anymore. So, we'll just kind of get past that. But, the housing bubble is just one example of all kinds of bubbles or, other risky loans that could be given out to people. And we really don't have any, financial stability there and a new system of dealing with this, right? And so there's really no telling what could happen overnight because of, greed or lack of long-term strategy that these financial institutions have. And so while obviously flawed, this system has continued for centuries. And it's all because we've had to trust a central authority, right? Both governments and now financial institutions, to keep that value stored so that we can feel secure and maintain our ability to purchase the goods and services we need.
So with all of that being said, how in the world does this apply to cryptocurrency?
Right. So out of that 2008 financial crisis that shocked the world, in that feeling of instability and people realizing that we really can't have this central authority that is playing this huge role in our day-to-day lives and our ability to provide a secure life savings for ourselves, a few different people, actually called the cypherpunk movement, began thinking about a way to create a decentralized form of currency and a way of creating this trust, but without that central authority, right? And so instead of putting trust in a central authority, you put trust in a technology that securely verifies transactions to take away the need of trust for an intermediary to make exchanges possible. And it also contains a finite amount of the currency to prevent that hyperinflation that we talked about. And so with cryptocurrencies, no one organization or institution can alter the value of the currency, and no government can intervene. The value of each currency is then dependent only on the supply and demand within the market. And the way this is all achieved is through the technology of the blockchain. And now we're about out of time for today's podcast, so we'll save the definition and analysis of blockchain and also the mechanisms behind and possible applications of cryptocurrency for the next episode that I host. So hopefully today, through revisiting the roots of monetary systems and our societal need for trust and decentralized power and security, you can understand why cryptocurrency has significant relevance to our economy and society's functioning. It both has the potential to allow individuals to save money without worry of hyperinflation, and it increases cooperation through building a trusted and secure network. So even if you're not a crypto supporter quite yet, which Richard, I know you are,
absolutely,
recognizing the underlying issues with the way our economy is set up is bound to drive this conversation and the changes that will help us as a global society figure out how to stop relying on centralized institutions.
That just goes to show that there's just so much more to learn and understand on how the banking systems work and how decentralization actually can be a positive in the world economy.
Absolutely. And we'll definitely dive more into that kind of economic analysis when we talk about blockchain and its possible applications. But for now, our next episode will be hosted by Adam Kenyon, who will describe why he got into cryptocurrency trading in the first place and how he is going to lead us through his journey of being a trader and being part of the cryptocurrency community. So this has been another episode of CryptoCurrent, bringing you one step closer to becoming a crypto and blockchain aficionado. We look forward to giving you the latest in crypto news and analysis next week. And stay CryptoCurrent.